I've decided that I would rather be lynched and burned than marry the young James Poodle.
Hmm.
Or burned and lynched.
Yes, yes.
Whichever is the more painful means of death first.
Quite.
This is ridiculous. Would everyone stop looking at their phones?
Hmm?
It's as if we can't have one single family meal without everyone looking at their phones.
I've only just got mine. It's brand new.
Oh, yes, of course. Phones are new for everyone. They were invented last month.
You're absolutely right, my dear. If we're not careful, these new telephones could spell the end of civilized discourse forever. Everybody, come on. Phones off tables, please. Thank you.
You too, Father.
Me? But what if I get an important call?
Well, they'll leave a message with the butler via telegram.
Telegram?
Petal!
Huh?
You too?
Well, you were talking to Father. I had to occupy myself to feel less awkward.
Granny!
I'm listening. I can multitask, you know.
Father, stop looking at your phone under the table.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you wouldn't notice.
Disgraceful. A family breakfast and the only one not looking at their phone is Bloody Thorn.
Oh, I lost mine. They make them too small these days. Will someone call it?
What's your number?
Six. Oh. Oh!
That's busy. That's probably...
That's it. No more calls. Not at the table, not from the table, not under the table.
That's the only place I have reception.
I found it in the toilet.
Everybody, let's stack our phones on the table. Come on, stack them up in the center of the table. Now, nobody even looks at their telephone until we have had a nice family breakfast.
Don't answer it. Nobody answer it.
But what if it's an important call?
They'll call back.
But I think it's for me. It's my ring.
It's everyone's ring. It's the ring.
You see? It's over. There was no crisis, no casualties, no issue gone unresolved.
A telegram, Your Lordship. Hello? Stop. Is anyone there? Stop. Huge crisis, many casualties, big problems. Why aren't you picking up? Stop. Signed, the Titanic. To hear this message again, say one.
One.
Hello? Stop. Is anyone there?
Hey, class. Surprise. I realized the irony of speaking to you from a screen about the dangers of screen time, but this is actually something that I've wanted to try for some time, and this weekend seemed as good a chance as any. So thanks for bearing with me. If this is a complete fail and it's terrible, tell me, and I'll never do it again. Fair enough? So let's start with the obvious. Our phones are a distraction. And we've all sat at those dinner tables, we've all had those conversations with friends where they can't seem to break free from whatever is so important. Maybe it's somebody's post on Facebook or a picture on Instagram or checking scores or something on CNN, who knows. But they just can't seem to tear themselves away. Phones are a distraction. And so it seems like that the solution would be really simple. Just put the phone down, right? How hard can it be? Just stop. Just put the phone down. But is it really that simple? Is it really that easy? I don't think it is. I was at a wedding some time ago, and I had performed the wedding, young couple, and so at the reception, I didn't have a place to sit. It wasn't assigned seating. And so I saw a table that had one of the only seats free, and I went and sat down with five or six 20-somethings, early 20-somethings, and every single one of them was on their phone. Not one word was being spoken amongst them. I mean, complete silence. And so I sat down and I began to just ask questions. You know, where are you from? And what did you study? And what are you doing now? And what do you hope to do? And one by one, they all put down their phone and they begin to engage. And they begin to have this really good conversation. But here's what I found. As soon as I stopped, they went back to their phones. I mean, I couldn't, if I quit asking questions, if I stopped engaging that individual person, then they would check out immediately. And I thought, man, what is it? Like, it's easy to say, put down your phone, but there's clearly something very powerful about our screens. And this isn't a surprise to really any of us. In fact, if you've ever read anything about phones, they are designed to get and to hold our attention. Everything about our phone is designed to get our attention and to never relinquish it. So in the 1930s, there was a psychologist by the name of B.F. Skinner, and he did a number of experiments with mice, and he would give them rewards, and he was trying to gauge how they responded to the rewards. And he came up with this theory called the variable reward schedule. And the reason for that is, or what he found was, that mice would respond more enthusiastically and more positively to reward when they didn't know when they would get it. If he gave it to them on a very consistent schedule, they began to take it for granted and they would actually lose interest. But when he varied when he would give them the reward and even how much of a reward he gave them, suddenly they were attentive. They were engrossed in, when am I going to get this reward? So if you go to a casino and you play the slot machine, it's based on this psychology, variable reward schedule. This is why when you play the slot machine, you don't win every time. You win sometimes, and sometimes you win a little bit, sometimes you win a lot. If you got the same amount of winning every single time, you'd lose interest. Why would you keep doing that? You know exactly what you're going to get every time. But if you don't win, but you know that you might win at some point, and then you do, then you're going to keep trying again and again and again. So casinos use this theory, this variable reward schedule, to keep people hooked, to make them addicted to gambling using the slot machines. Just one example. Another way that we use that even is in this presentation. I don't want you to get distracted and to check out, and so I'll use different slides, not at the same time constantly, but at varied times, because when you are watching and you see a new slide, instantly it grabs your attention. Isn't that cool? This is one of the reasons that we like to scroll in Facebook, right? We scroll because there's always something new, and I like that new information, that new novelty, and I never know exactly when I'm going to get it. So our phones are built around this idea of giving us rewards, but not always when we expect them. Instagram, for example, withholds likes on pictures that you post. So you might get one, maybe you don't get any for a little while, but then you need to know. You need to know, when are you going to get a like? And then you get a bunch. And so then that makes you want to check again later. So our phones, social media platforms, they are designed around this variable reward schedule. It hooks us in. It changes the way that we think. And then we almost, in a sense, hear our phones calling to us. It's like, man, I got to check and see if somebody liked my post. Oh, they did. Fantastic. And in that, I get a reward. What reward is that? It's called dopamine. So dopamine is that chemical in your brain that motivates behavior. And so when you do certain things that your brain wants you to keep doing, it releases dopamine. You get a sense of pleasure and you go, oh, I want to do that again. So for example, you could be eating a really good meal. And as you eat that perfectly cooked steak, your brain gives you a shot of dopamine. And you go, oh, this is good. I want to eat more of the steak. Restaurants, by the way, have learned how to manipulate fat and salt in order to create the type of flavor that our brain likes so that it gives us a shot of dopamine so that we want to keep eating. So just a little tidbit there. That's why McDonald's, you want it even though you know it's terrible and it even tastes bad. But your brain somehow goes, oh man, I could use some more French fries. When you have sex, shot of dopamine. When you get something new, novelty, a new bit of information that piques your interest, that gives you a shot of dopamine. Again, this is why we scroll through Instagram. It's, oh man, that's a new bit of information, or maybe why you're on ESPN or CNN or Pinterest, and you keep scrolling because even though you've seen all the same stuff, there might be something new. And again, it's just giving you this shot of dopamine. For our purposes, though, a positive social interaction gives us a shot of dopamine. So social media plays on this, that I post a picture or I post something and I get a like. And when I do that, boom, I get this shot of dopamine that says, oh, I liked that. Let me post something else. Let me stay on social media. Let me stay on this on my phone. Now, that might sound like an overstatement. Maybe I'm exaggerating it. But certainly not everyone thinks that, including people who work in social media. So one former vice president of user growth at Facebook, he said this recently, I feel tremendous guilt. The short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we have created are destroying how society works. So understand that your phone is designed to get and to hold your attention. It uses variable reward schedule. It uses, they know they're doing things to trigger this dopamine, and you put the two of those things together, and it changes our pattern of behavior. we have to check our phones, and it creates addicts. And not only that, but in a very real sense, your phone is actually calling to you. In a study published last year in the Journal for Association of Consumer Research, just having your phone near you can reduce your ability to problem solve and reduce your working memory. So here's what it says. Let me just read this to you. We have limited attentional resources, and we use some of them to point the rest of those resources in the right direction. Usually different things are important in different contexts, but some things, like your name, have a really privileged status. So what they're saying is, what they're describing is what all of us have experienced, where you're sitting in a crowded room and everybody's talking, but then you hear your name over in a corner, and your brain is tuned in to give extra attention to your name. And so immediately your ears are perked and you have to hear what that person is saying about you. Or perhaps if you hear your child calling out for you in the other room, or even your child crying in the other room, your brain as a parent is wired to be tuned in to your child's voice or their cry. Even if it's super faint because it's the middle of the night and they're across the house, you still hear them somehow, or at least I do. Maybe some of you don't. Okay, so here's what he continues. This idea with smartphones is that it's similarly relevant all of the time, and it gets this privileged additional attentional space. That's not the default for other things. In other words, our phones get special attentional space because there are so many things on our phones that are fighting for our attention and that are all significant to us. They are all calling our names in a sense. And so if we get addicted to our phones, or we begin to give it that type of attention, then it compounds and our phones in a real sense begin to whisper to us and they're distracting to us. So imagine for a second that you're trying to work on your taxes, and you sit down, or maybe your budget, and you sit down at the kitchen table and you're trying to work out with your spreadsheets everything that you know, your budget, and you're working with numbers and there's money missing, and so you're looking at your bank account versus receipts and all of that. And you've got a three-year-old who's over there pulling on your leg going, "Mom, Mom, Mom," or "Dad, Dad, Dad." It's super distracting, isn't it? You can't focus. So in the same way, if you're sitting there trying to work on a problem, if your phone is anywhere near you, even if it's in the house, what this study is saying is that it's essentially whispering your name. Lucas, Lucas, Lucas. One psychologist from UCLA, he compares this to someone who is, if you're trying to focus on something, but you're trying to give up cigarettes, trying to give up smoking, and someone comes and places a pack of cigarettes next to you. It'd be really hard to focus, right? Or if you're on a diet and someone comes and places a piece of chocolate cake next to you and you're like, "I'm trying to focus on this," but it's very distracting. It's the same idea. Your phone is whispering your name. But not only that, did you catch what the result is? The phone is making us dumber. Our smartphones, the irony, are making us stupid. Because they're distracting us, because they're whispering our names and calling to us. Did you catch what it said? Our working memory is reduced and our ability to problem solve deteriorates. So in a very real sense, our smartphones are calling to us, and because they're distracting us, we are getting dumber. Why else would we endanger our lives and the lives of others on the road by texting while we drive? Because our phone is whispering to us, calling to us, answer this text, read this text. That if we do it, we get a shot of dopamine. So what do we do? And I think there's actually a better question that we need to ask before that. And that's this: who are we supposed to be? What were we made for? So think of it this way. As a pastor, I have certain things that I need to be good at to do my job as a pastor. That's who I am. That's my job. And those things are very different than, say, my dad, who's an architect. So the fact that I'm not really great at math and design is not really my thing, and project management, again, don't really know how to do any of that, doesn't really affect my job on a day-to-day basis. But I do need to be able to think critically. I need to be able to teach and to explain clearly the ideas that I'm reading about, and also to be able to communicate, most importantly, God's word accurately. So I need to be able to do all of those things. Whereas my dad, the fact that, you know, he doesn't really want to stand up and speak publicly doesn't really affect him. See, who we are supposed to be, I'm a pastor, he's an architect, changes how we answer the question, well, what should we do and what should we be good at? Or think of it this way: if a quarterback and a lineman both try to do the same things, it doesn't work very well. A lineman who picks up a ball and then tries to throw it downfield, he's going to be on the bench pretty quick. a quarterback who tries to block an oncoming rusher is probably going to be in the hospital. So who we are, the role that we have, what we were made for matters before we can answer the question, what should we do? So who were we made to be? In Genesis 1:26, God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So if you go all the way back to Genesis, we find that we were created to be imagers of God. We were supposed to reflect God. Now, in the ancient Near East, this was a very clearly understood concept. A king or an emperor or something in the ancient Near East, a ruler, they would take images of themselves and they would place them in places where they were not physically living in order to communicate that they were still in charge. That was their domain. So a king who lives over here might then put a statue in this town over here, this village over here, to communicate, hey, I'm not there physically, and yet you are under my sovereign rule. I rule here. I reign here. This is my territory. This is my turf. So you see this even today. We see statues all over the world. Some of them are really beautiful. King Alfred the Great. This is one of the great kings of England who actually unified England. And there were statues of him throughout England to tell everyone, this is your king. He is over you. And you would see him and you would think of him and you would know who your sovereign was. This one's really beautiful. Not all of them were that beautiful. This is Edrimi. He was the slave turned king in 16th century Turkey. Not a looker, Edrimi. Not a handsome fellow, but you get the idea. This is one of my favorites. This is a linen statue. And of course, when they made the statue, what was it to communicate? Linen is in charge here. This is his domain. But then in Odessa, Ukraine, after the fall of the Iron Curtain, they transformed it into Darth Vader. And now it emits free Wi-Fi. So there you go. So you and I, we are created to be imagers of God. We have dominion over the earth. We are to be his stewards, and we are to carry out his will, his agenda. We're supposed to reign in his place, in a sense. Not our own agenda, not our own will, but his. Understand then, imagers are not passive. We're not distracted. We're not checked out because God isn't. And we're supposed to reflect God. Imagers instead are to be fully engaged, fully present wherever they are because we have a crazy, awesome, amazing responsibility to look like God, to be his representatives. That when people see us, they go, oh, that's what God must be like. Think about that for a second. That when people see us, it is communicating to them in some sense, this is what God is like. Are we doing a good job of that? We want our kids then, because they too are created to be imagers of God, to be fully engaged and fully present. Not distracted, not passive, not checked out, to be fully engaged and fully present. That's our aim. That's who we're called to be. So how do we do that? We need to limit their access to the drugs. I mean, phones. So limiting screen time is a must. Like if you have some sort of crazy, we don't even worry about that, then you are setting your kids up for failure. You are encouraging them to be checked out and distracted and passive individuals. So a few best practices for you. The first one is to set time limits for screen time. We want to set specific time limits for screen time according to some sort of a schedule. And so you have to decide this for your family. It may be based on the day or the week or the month or the year, however you want to do it, but have a specific amount of time set. And then, again, remember, we want to answer this question of how much based on what will be useful for our kids to help them with this end goal in mind become fully engaged and fully present people. So for Carrie and I, our kids understand that they get screen time on Saturdays, usually for 30 minutes to an hour. But then we connect that screen time to their attitude throughout the week. So they get to earn or lose screen time based on their attitude. Were they respectful? Did they get along? Were there any temper tantrums? Were there any attitude issues that we need to address? And so our kids know, I'm going to get screen time, but it's based on our attitude. And for us, this makes sense because oftentimes what suffers because of screen time is their attitude. So we're just connecting those two for them. But again, as parents, and this is going to look different for different age groups. We've got younger kids, so that's how it works for us. If you've got older kids, it's going to look different. But what we want to do is set this on the basis of that end goal in mind, that our kids would be imagers of God, fully engaged and fully present. So then on that basis, what do these limits look like? How should I limit my kids' screen time in order to get that result? All right, so number two is to create screen-free zones. And hopefully this goes without saying that bedrooms, for example, should be screen-free zones. The dinner table should be screen-free zones. Car time should be screen-free zones, unless it's like a road trip or something like that. Restaurants, I know this is terrifying to some of you with younger kids, that should be a screen-free zone. Why? Because what I don't want to do is teach my kids that they are dependent upon a screen to be well-behaved. Let me say that again. I do not want to reinforce to my kids that they need something to distract them in order for them to be on their best behavior. Instead, what I want is to train my kids to have good behavior, to be on their best behavior, to be respectful and to be quiet and to learn how to engage in adult conversation from an early age instead of quickly taking the easy route of saying, here, look at a screen and be distracted. The temptation is oftentimes to take that easy route. And I get it, because you're at a restaurant or in the car and the kids are fighting in the back and it's like, just take a screen and then you'll be quiet and then we can have a quiet meal and so on. I get that. And you know what? We've done it. I'm not saying it's always wrong. And I certainly am not saying that we've done it perfectly. But on the whole, I do not want that to be our default. I want our kids to learn how to sit quietly at a table and to ask questions and to engage in conversation. I want our kids in a car to learn how to sit quietly or to sing songs or to look out the window, right? Oftentimes, our temptation is to try to quickly ease boredom. We look at boredom as like it's this terrible thing for kids. And when you're in a restaurant, you feel it because the kids get bored and then they start acting out. But we want to teach our kids to have self-control. And so many other times when they're bored, that's a beautiful thing. My kids are way more creative when they're bored. We've got Lego for them. We've got a piano that they just sort of like bang on. We've got games for them to play, books to read. And when they're bored, if I say, well, here's a tablet, here's a screen, what do you think they're going to do? But if I say, hey, you're bored, go find something to do. Or I take that step of engaging myself in their world and doing something with them. Well, that's completely changed the narrative. All right, third thing, make eye contact. This is one that as parents, we've got to do a good job of as well. We've got to model this for our kids. It's so tempting to have our phones and our kids are talking to us. We're sort of half answering. So look, I understand that there's sometimes that you need to be answering something on your phone. So do the respectful thing that you would want other people to do for you and tell your kids, hey, buddy, 1 second, or sweetheart, 1 minute. I'm gonna do this and then I'm going to put it down. And then do that. Follow through. Finish your email, finish your text, put it down, and then look them in the eye, engage with them. If we want our kids to engage with us, especially as they get older, as teenagers, if we want our kids to be able to engage with others, then we've got to model that. And if I'm checking out on my phone and kind of half answering them, what am I teaching them? So I give my kids, as best I can, again, I don't always do it perfectly, but this is my intention, and more often than not, I think I do this well. I'm putting down my phone and now I'm looking at you. I may get down at their level because I got little kids. I'm listening to you. And so I give them that respect and then I get to expect it of them. So on Saturdays when they're sitting on the couch and they're playing their tablets and I have something to tell them, I come in and I say, hey guys, pause it and look at me. And they put their tablets down and they look at me and I get eye contact. We're going to have this conversation. You're going to listen to what I say. You're going to be fully engaged and fully present with Dad right now. And it's not just when they have screens. It's anytime. This is a good policy. This is a good training for any time. My kids can be distracted with any number of things, not just screens. And so whenever I can, I try to stop and I make sure I engage with them, but then I demand that of them. I expect that from them. Hey, I'm talking to you. I need your attention. And my kids have learned to do that. They learn that that's the expectation. Because I want my kids to be fully engaged, fully present, and to show someone else respect and to learn how to listen well. We want to beat our phones at their own game. We want to beat screens at their own game. So think of it this way. If the allure of our phones and social media and all of that social validation is pulling our kids and training them to be addicts essentially to their screens, then what I want to do is create what Andy Crouch calls nudges, okay? Our phones are whispering to us, they're calling us, but what we want to do is create the opposite effect, nudges that motivate and push our kids towards being fully engaged and fully present, not on their phones or on their screens. So telling our kids to put down their phones and their tablets in the car is a good first step. But as any addict will tell you, you have to take that empty space then and fill it with something else. Let's take the negative and let's fill it with something positive. And this is where, as parents, we've got to be creative. We've got to create environments and take advantage of those opportunities to then motivate our kids to be fully engaged and fully present. This is training, and we can't be lazy about this. So let me give you a few examples. In our car, it's so easy just to say, hey, stop fighting, get on your tablet in the back. You know, I've got two boys in the back and they beat on each other. But instead, what I want to do is create opportunity. Car time is a tremendous opportunity to have a conversation with my kids. My kids are fairly young, so we don't have a lot to talk about at this point. Sometimes they do, they'll surprise you. But then the other thing we do is we just engage in games. You know, we play guessing games, we play the alphabet game, we listen to stories on CD. If you've got older kids, middle school, teenagers, they may not want to talk to you and they may not want to play a bunch of silly games. But if we immediately give them a tablet or immediately tell them, of course, you can be on your phone or whatever, then we're eliminating the possibility of having conversation. And that doesn't mean that every time you get in the car, it's going to be this memorable family moment. But even creating the opportunity gives that very thing, opportunity that you don't have otherwise. Same thing around the dinner table. Yeah, you may have teenagers, middle school, they don't want to talk, maybe they just give one word answers. But finding ways to engage them, finding ways to find out what they're interested in, their music, their hobbies, whatever, and learning to engage them in conversation is super important. Telling stories is one way that our family has always bonded. I grew up with an uncle who's always telling stories about the family, and it creates this sense of belonging and attachment. In our family, again, we've got young kids. We play a lot of games at dinner. Sometimes they'll tell me all about their day, sometimes they don't. If I want to know what their day is, we play a game called Two Truths and a Lie. They tell me two things that happened and one thing that didn't, and I have to guess what it is. It's a game to them, but I'm learning about their day, and they're learning how to talk about their day. We play guessing games, guess the animal, or guess my favorite color, or guess what I see. And then we play a game where we make up stories, and everybody starts with a sentence and adds on a sentence. You know that game? And it's a riot. It always leads to ridiculous chaos, hysterical laughter. And what happens in that moment? The same thing that they're getting on their phones with that social validation, now they're getting in a real life environment as our family. They're getting that same shot of dopamine, and it's telling them, this is good. This is where I belong. One of the reasons that teenagers are looking to this social validation from their peers and not to us as parents oftentimes, and so they don't want to talk to us a lot, but they're going to their peer group, they're on social media, what do they think? It's because they're trying to figure out who they are, and they're trying to figure out where they belong. And so mom and dad, it may be that your teenager doesn't want to talk to you all the time, but what you can communicate to them consistently is that they belong here, that this is home, that they're loved and they're accepted. And then whatever they're figuring out about their life, they know whatever happens, they can always come back. This is home. This is where they're loved. This is where they're accepted. But they're not going to get that message if we are checked out on our phones. If you've got older kids, teenagers and above, one other thing that you can do that's super valuable is make your home the destination place for your kids and their friends. I realize that may be a terrifying idea for you. You're thinking, that is not my idea of a fun Friday night, and I do not have a teenager-proof house, and it's going to be loud, and they're going to be up late, and all the rest of it. Maybe you need to rethink some of those things, because maybe it's worth it. I mean, our kids are spending all their time in their phones, they're on social media in this virtual world, and it's not leading to good things, as we talked about last week. But what if your home was the place that kids could actually come in real life and have real conversations face-to-face, not virtual, not online, not two-dimensional, but real 3D human relationships? What a crazy idea. I think that would be a very popular place to be for a lot of kids these days. We've got to create these nudges, as Andy Crouch says, that move us away and move our kids away from the shallow reality of the virtual world, the superficial relationships of social media, and instead pull us and push us towards real engagement, real life, three-dimensional, knowing and listening and being heard and sharing thoughts and ideas with real live human people in the world, because that's what it means to be imagers of God. And make no mistake, this is going to take courage. And you're going to hear me say this throughout the series, that it takes courage to set limits for your kids. It takes courage to help them think through these things. It takes courage to tell them no on occasion, especially if you've never done it before. And they're not going to thank you. If you've not set some of these patterns and habits for your family, it's the first time you're trying to do it, they're not going to be overjoyed with you. And let me tell you, it takes courage to be a parent. Just in general. You know, so oftentimes we get caught up trying to be our kids' buddies because we're afraid they won't like us, but our kids don't need buddies, they need parents. And it takes courage to be a parent, to be fully engaged, to make eye contact, to really listen, to empathize, to hear our kids, and then to help give them direction. That takes courage. But that's what we want for our kids, and there is so much at stake here. So much more than just trying to protect our kids from the evils of technology. We want our kids to be imagers of Jesus Christ who are in the world. And let me tell you, to be in the world, it takes courage. In John 17:15, Jesus prays, "My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world." See, this is what Jesus prays for his disciples. And by the way, that includes all of us who've come since, who are his followers. Not that God would take us out of the world, but that we would be in the world as his imagers. I mean, what's the point of being an imager if you're not in the world, if you're not in a foreign land? And so as being made in the image of God, we are stakes in the ground that are announcing that God's kingdom is coming, that King Aslan is on the move. And so Jesus is praying for us that we would be in the world, to be fully engaged and fully present. And in that, it takes courage. And no one knows it better than Jesus. I mean, think about Jesus. This is what we're going to celebrate this next month. The incarnation that Jesus stepped into humanity, into our place, to be one of us. Instead of standing off passive and checked out and distracted, Jesus said, "No, I will be fully engaged and fully present as one of you." It takes tremendous courage to enter into this broken and fallen world, especially knowing that he was going to ultimately be ridiculed and mocked and beaten and die, tortured and killed for our sake. It takes courage to be fully engaged and fully present, and no one knows it better than Jesus. But we are his imagers. We are the body of Christ. We are the incarnation of Jesus now on this earth. See, what is at stake is so much bigger than just managing our screen time. It's so much bigger than getting a notification that my screen time is down 10% this week. That's fantastic, but it's way bigger than that. It's even bigger than protecting our kids from the danger of social media and online bullying and sexting and pornography. All those are terrible things, but it's so much bigger than that. What's at stake here is, who are we becoming? What were we made for? To be imagers of God. See, God didn't create our kids to be passive and distracted and checked out. He didn't create us for that either. He created us to be fully engaged and fully present. And I see so many people walking through life like this. And we live on our phones and we become almost two-dimensional people floating through life like ghosts, semi-human. When God calls us to be fully embodied imagers, engaged, present, loving, caring, listening, serving. That's what God desires for you. That's what he desires for our families and for our kids and for our church. Because what the world needs, listen to me, what the world needs is people who are fully engaged, fully present, who look like Jesus.